Well, good morning, everybody. Welcome to Bio 231, Human Anatomy. And today is the 14th of October. We're going to start nervous system today. And I know you're going to be interested. This is a fun part of the class, nervous system. Brain, spinal cord, all that kind of stuff, receptors. So this is about as loud as I can turn the microphone up without it screeching. So hold on, you guys. Let's get started with lecture. All right. Let's see. Announcement? Oh, we lost our SI leader. So there won't be SI anymore, unfortunately. And probably I won't be able to find somebody to take her place. That's just the way that goes. So that's an announcement. The other announcement, the Monday lab practicums are graded. You guys, you're just too rowdy today. Too rowdy. And maybe I just have to turn all the lights off. Okay. Don't forget, your voice is coming through on the microphone here. So you'll get in trouble if I can hear your voice after the class. So the lab practicums for Monday are graded. They're in Blackboard. And the Wednesday groups are finishing up their practicums. So later on this afternoon, everybody will be halfway done with the class. So congratulations. And of course, I want you to review your lecture exams and your practicums. We go over them in lab. Or you can see me during office hours, too, and look over it and ask me questions. Right? And what else? I think that's about it. We are on schedule. So that's the last of my announcements. Does anybody have a question? Probably not, because we've covered this. You've been tested on everything we've covered so far. But in case someone has a question, anybody have a question? We're good? Okay, sign-in sheet is going around. Make sure you sign that sign-in sheet. And we said today is the 14th. Indeed. When is the next lecture exam? 4.5 weeks away. All right, so that's a pretty long period of time, but don't get disinterested in the class. Print out those study guides right away, because when I make up a lecture test, I go to the study guide to make sure I'm asking you the right stuff. All right, I don't just make up questions. I want to make sure that you're studying the right stuff and I test you on the right material. So that's sort of like a contract that I have. All right, so that's November 16th, exam 3, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, and 17. The last exam, there'll even be more chapters, but that's because these get pretty short toward the end of the class. All right, so I know the first exam only had 5 chapters, right? And this last one you had 5, and then it kind of bumps up a little bit. All right? And notice, way before the next lecture exam, you have the third practicum. So there's going to be basically 2.5 labs. Before the next practicums, because this week is about a half a lab, and then next week and the week after, and then you have your third practicum. So nobody has a practicum and a lecture exam on the same day. I think that's good, though I've heard some students say that when they studied for the lecture exam, that helped them with the practicum and vice versa, so because the materials relate to each other. All right, so those of you that still have to take a lecture exam and a practicum on the same day, which is going to be the last day of the semester, just get an early start studying that stuff. And, you know, I think when you study for the practicum, that will help you with the lecture material and vice versa. All right, because I know a bunch of you have that Wednesday lab. All right, so that's it for the schedule. I don't think there's any questions with the schedule. Are there questions? No questions. Okay. All right, so here are the lecture notes. And this slide is okay, but let's just start right here. Okay, the nervous system. The nervous system is something that's very important because it helps us interact with our environment. So we have receptors so that we can perceive light and we can perceive sound and temperature. And then we can make a decision on what we want to do with all of that information. And then when our brain makes a decision, it can send that decision out to various other parts of your body very quickly. Right, so you receive information quickly, it's processed quickly, and then it's sent out to some what we call effector organs, for instance, like skeletal muscle, and that information gets to skeletal muscle and other effectors very rapidly. So that is what the nervous system is for, The other thing, if there is a fast onset of some kind of operation, then the duration is short. All right, so the nervous system acts very rapidly, but for a short duration. There's another control system in your body that works. That's the endocrine system. Endocrine system usually takes a little bit longer period of time to have an effect, but it also means that it is more long-lasting. All right, so the nervous system is fast but short-lasting. Endocrine system is slow but more long-lasting. So let's look at some things that can take place very rapidly in your body and then disappear, because then your nervous system is ready for new information. So here we have the nervous system, the basic divisions of the nervous system, and you learned some body cavities before. All right, so we have the central nervous system, because it's sort of right on midline of the body. We have the brain within the cranium and the spinal cord, which is in the vertebral column. So that is the central nervous system. And then every other nervous tissue that is outside the central nervous system is what we call the peripheral nervous system. All right, so I think the central nervous system is in like this green color or beige color. What color is this right here? Beige. Yeah, it's in this beige color. And the peripheral nervous system is in this yellow color. So you can just look at this illustration and see what the central and peripheral nervous system is. All right, so how is this all arranged inside your body? So here is a pretty important figure. And even when you get into physiology, most things in physiology, you want to relate to this particular figure as well. So let's take a look. Over here, we have the brain and we have the spinal cord right over here. So if we put the brain and spinal cord together, what do we get? The central nervous system, right? Central nervous system. Okay, so central nervous system is contained within this block. Kind of looks like gray to me. All right, so that's central nervous system, and everything outside is the peripheral nervous system. All right, so this light blue and whatever color this is here, tell me what color this is. Red? Pink? Okay, pink. Yeah, so we got blue and pink. This represents the peripheral nervous system. And the reason why they're two different colors is because, let's look at the arrows. All right, can you tell that the arrows are pointing in two different directions? If information is entering the central nervous system, like I see right here, we call that a sensory neuron. If information is leaving the central nervous system, we call that a motor neuron. And as a matter of fact, there's another name for sensory, and you should probably write this down because I'll use these terms interchangeably. Sensory and afferent are the same thing. Afferent and sensory means information is going from the periphery into where? The central nervous system. If it's motor, there's another name for motor, and that is called efferent. Right? If it's an efferent nerve, information starts in the central nervous system and ends up where? In the peripheral nervous system. All right, so that's what a motor outflow pathway looks like. Right, starts in the CNS and goes into the periphery. All right, so this right here is a response loop. Sometimes we call it a reflex loop, but probably a response loop is a better way of thinking about this. And it's got a number of pieces. Let's go over the pieces. All right, so here we have an eye, and the eye generally we're going to say is a receptor. In order for you to perceive some kind of energy, you need a receptor for it. And if you're going to perceive light, what kind of receptor do you need? You need a light receptor or a photoreceptor, and it just so happens that photoreceptors are in our eyes. Right? So there's a receptor right here. And then that receptor sends information into the afferent neuron, and where does the afferent neuron take that information? Into the central nervous system, and it's going to go way back here in the brain. This is the visual center of the brain. We don't know the names of the lobes of the brain just yet, but you know what? You sort of do. It's named after the bone that's right here. What's the name of this bone? That's the occipital bone, and so that's the occipital lobe, and so the primary visual cortex is in the occipital lobe of the brain, and there that information is processed. You can recognize light patterns as letters or words, right, or objects like trees. things like that. That happens in this part of the central nervous system. Okay, so information is shared between different parts of the nervous system, and there is a nerve that's completely within the central nervous system, and this nerve right here is neither an afferent or efferent nerve. This is what we call an association neuron or an interneuron. Interneuron means between afferent and efferent neurons, interneuron. And interneurons are always 100% contained within the central nervous system. And notice, afferent neurons partly are in the peripheral nervous system and partly in the central nervous system. Efferent neurons are partly in the central nervous system and partly in the peripheral nervous system because they move in and out. But interneurons or association neurons are only found in the central nervous system. All right, and this is also an interesting figure because you see these arrows, and is this a one-way arrow or a two-way arrow? It's a one-way arrow. And I see one neuron right here, and neurons can transmit information only in one direction. Right, so if there's a neuron bringing information into the central nervous system, it can't be used to take information out. There has to be another cell that does that job. All right, so how does this response loop start? Well, first the stimulus has to be picked up by a receptor. Receptor sends information into the afferent neuron, which goes into the central nervous system, where there are interneurons, and in the central nervous system there is a process called integration taking place. So not only information from your eye gets into the central nervous system, but information from all over the place, right? From tactile receptors on the surface of your body, taste and smell and hearing as well are all added up together, and then this brain makes a decision on what to do with that information. For instance, if you heard a horn sounding right now going on and off, right, and that light over there flashing, right, so your brain is going to integrate that information up, and what would be a good decision if that were to happen? Okay, probably leave the classroom because that's a fire alarm sound, right? All right, so depending on the nature of the light and sound and a whole bunch of other variables, the brain will make different kinds of decisions. And then it sends that information out the motor pathway, and in this particular case to a skeletal muscle. Remember, skeletal muscle you have under voluntary control. So even if that fire alarm was going off and the light was flashing, you could just stay there if you wanted to, right, until you told these skeletal muscles to contract. So here is a skeletal muscle. Okay, there are two things that are really important that I don't have on the word slide over here, which we should draw in on this slide or draw it in on your notes. What always starts a response loop? All right, so here we have that receptor. The receptor is observing light. That light is what we call a stimulus. So a response loop always starts with a stimulus. And in order to perceive that stimulus, you have to have the proper kind of receptor. Right, and then the receptor sends information in the afferent neuron to the integration center, makes a decision, sends information out through the efferent pathway, and this right here, this muscle, is what we call an effector organ. Right, so an efferent pathway goes to an effector organ, and this effector organ always produces this arrow right here, and this is what we call a response. So the last thing that happens in a response loop is a response. The first thing that happens is a stimulus. And as a matter of fact, maybe you could even draw in a little arrow right here if you have these slides or your textbook, right? Because the stimulus enters the body, is picked up by a receptor. All right, so that's a nice response loop. So what does a response loop always start with? Stimulus, and it always ends with a response, right? And so what can detect a stimulus? What can detect a stimulus? A receptor. And what can produce a response? An effector, right? An effector organ. And since this is going to a skeletal muscle, this is a special kind of neuron. We call that a somatic motor neuron that's going to your skeletal muscle, and you have voluntary control of all those skeletal muscles in your body. And as a matter of fact, that's the only thing you have voluntary control of. So we're going to look at the system first. Okay, let's look at this next slide. It's a little bit complicated. So I have redrawn, okay, this slide in your notes with just kind of a flow diagram so that this is a better way to view what we're going to talk about in this class. And then you can relate what I have in the notes to this picture and you'll be in pretty good shape. So we're going to think about the nervous system in totality, right? So every kind of nervous tissue we can break down into two divisions. And I think they're kind of familiar with this already. There is the central nervous system versus the peripheral nervous system, right? And you should know where those neurons are. And remember, central nervous system is brain and spinal cord. Peripheral is everything else. Furthermore, the peripheral nervous system we can break down into two components. And we did it right here. One component is sensory and the other is motor. And you should know where these signals are going. Where do they start? Where do they end up? So if the sensory information is coming from the periphery into the central nervous system, sensory, and another name for sensory is afferent, right? The afferent division. So sensory is just a way of bringing information from sensory organs into the central nervous system. And then the second one is the efferent division. Another name for efferent is motor. So here signals are moving out of the central nervous system to an effector organ in the periphery someplace. All right, well, if we look at the motor or efferent division, we can break it down into two main components as well. And if it goes to skeletal muscle, like I see in this diagram right here, remember that's under voluntary control, we call that the somatic nervous system, somatic. And another name for soma or somatic is body. And anything that's superficial on your person that's not deep inside a body cavity, we consider that a somatic region, a body region. And anything deep inside, we're going to call that a visceral region. So somatic just means superficial, and a good way to think about that is skeletal muscle and bones, for instance. And that is under voluntary control. Somatic and voluntary match up perfectly. The other motor division is autonomic. All right, so if somatic controls skeletal muscle, the autonomic nervous system controls everything else pretty much automatically without conscious thought. So you don't have to think about all the things that it's doing all the time. We don't call it automatic, we call it autonomic nervous system. And this nervous system is going deep inside body cavities to innervate various kinds of organs, like your heart, your digestive tract, your lungs, right, are all inside body cavities, reproductive tract, urinary tract, right, all of those visceral organs. All right, and you notice now the autonomic nervous system can be broken down into some components. How many components can it be broken down into? Two, because I see two arrows right here, right? All right, so you're looking at the slide, and the two divisions are sympathetic nervous system and parasympathetic nervous system. These are divisions of the autonomic nervous system, and these are motor, so it's taking signals from the central nervous system to viscera. Viscera are organs deep inside body cavities, right? And just like for the somatic nervous system, we have to know what the effector organ is, and that's a skeletal muscle. We should also know what the effector organ is for the autonomic nervous system, or maybe there's more than one. We should know what the effector organs are for the autonomic nervous system, and here they are. There are three. There's smooth muscle. You can't control smooth muscle. It's controlled by itself or with the autonomic nervous system. Cardiac muscle, right, is regulated with the autonomic nervous system. It's not under voluntary control, and glands as well. So if you start exercising and your body temperature increases and you start to sweat, there's no way that you can voluntarily stop sweating, right? Because it's under autonomic control, not voluntary control. So when we look at anything in the next three or four chapters, I want you to be able to relate it to this first information on this first page, which is pretty much the exact information that we have in the textbook, but this is just in a little bit better synopsis, a little bit better short form. Okay, so make sure you know what the effector organs are for those two different nervous systems. voluntary versus autonomic. Okay, and here you can probably see that the divisions are very similar to that other, the page that I gave you, but instead here are some organs. So here's the heart. Is the heart a somatic muscle or a visceral muscle? And why? You guys are good. It's a visceral muscle because it is deep inside a body cavity. While the biceps brachii, is that a somatic or visceral muscle? That's a somatic muscle because it's not deep inside a body cavity. Okay. Right there. Both effector organs, but located in different places. All right, nervous tissue. When we did some histology, we learned that there are two main kinds of cells that make up nervous system, right? And the two major kinds of cells are what we call neurons, and then the other are called support cells, or neuroglia. And we're going to take a look at some of those. So let's start by looking at a neuron. Oops, neuron. So here is a really good illustration of a neuron. It's a special kind of neuron. We'll learn what's special about this after we learn some of these general pieces. Here is what we call the cell body. And what did we call body before, just a couple seconds ago? What's another name for body? Soma, right? Somatic region. So sometimes this major part of a neuron is called the soma as well. So here's the cell body or soma. I see a bunch of projections coming off the cell body. These are short and highly branched. These are what we call dendrites. Dendrites are the receiving part of this neuron. Right? And then I see another process coming off the cell body, and this one is not branched very much, and it's very long. It's much longer than the dendrites. This single long process coming off is called an axon. So the three parts of a neuron are dendrites, the cell body, and an axon. And the axon can be extremely long. Even though this is a microscopic structure, you need a microscope to see even this nucleus right here. This axon could be a meter long because it might go from your spinal cord all the way down to the tip of your toe. But you still can't see it because, right, the diameter is still too small to see. But it's very, very long. All right, so those are the three parts. So a neuron can generate electrical impulses, and the electrical impulses flow over the cell membrane, and they only flow in one direction. And do you see where that direction is? Do you see an arrow? How about on this axon right here? Is this arrow a one-way arrow or a two-way arrow? It's a one-way arrow. So information can only flow from a dendrite to cell body down an axon to the axon terminals. Information can't flow backwards. Right, so in the forward direction, we call that antegrade. If it's going in the reverse direction, we call that retrograde. So retrograde motion of an impulse does not take place. That never happens. Right, so if we have a neuron that's sending information from left to right, if information needs to go from right to left, what do you need? You need another neuron, right, that is facing the other way. All right, if you need bidirectional transmission of information, then you need at least two neurons because one neuron can only transmit information in one direction. Okay, so I see the nucleus. I see some rough endoplasmic reticulum, and it's busy making proteins. This endoplasmic reticulum is also called Nissl substance or Nissl bodies because it picks up a stain. It's easy to see underneath a microscope. This area right here that looks like a funnel, I think that's a really good way to understand what its physiology is as well, right? Because the structure determines what the function is, right? We said that the dendrites are the receiving end of the neuron, and the axon is the sending end, because I see the direction of that nerve impulse. And it's the job of this funnel right here, which we call the axon hillock, to get information from all of the dendrites in the cell body and group them all together before it sends the information down through this axon. And as a matter of fact, this nerve can even decide whether or not to send the information down the axon or not, depending on the nature of the signals when it reaches the axon hillock, when it reaches this funnel region. All right, so information flows. Dendrite cell body down an axon as an electrical signal, and that's why it's fast. So this cell can transmit information very, very rapidly. The other kind of cell that we see on this illustration are support cells. And I see that there is a cell that's wrapped around the axon. So this axon is a gold color. This kind of gray color right here is another cell, and this is called a Schwann cell. And they're not continuous. There are gaps between the Schwann cells. And the job of this Schwann cell is to allow this electrical impulse to skip down the axon. And the space between Schwann cells is called a node of Ranvier. I see it right here. So a nerve impulse, right, will skip from one node to the other, to the other, to the other, and it's fast, right, when that happens. Think about being at the top of the stairs. We'll have two people on the top of the stairs, but we won't actually do this experiment. Right? Let's have two people, just do it in your mind. And this person over here, we're going to tell them to run down the stairs as fast as they can, but the person over here has to step on every single stair. They can't skip any. Okay? Well, the person over here, let's say they're strong enough, they can skip two stairs. Right? So they can skip two, land on the third stair, right? Then the sixth one, and then the ninth one. Which one will get down to the bottom of the stairs faster? The one that can skip down or the one that has to step on every single stair? Yeah, the one that skips, right? Same thing for a nerve impulse. If it can skip down the axon, then it is propagated very quickly. As a matter of fact, hundreds of times faster. These cells, Schwann cells, act as insulators. That insulating material is called myelin, and so sometimes we call it a myelin sheath. That myelin sheath allows for that speedy nerve conduction, and we call that saltatory conduction, which is fast, hundreds of times faster. We'll take a look at this neurolemma. All right, this axon terminus has special regions. We can't quite see it on this illustration, but there's going to be a bulge at the end of this axon, and it's going to have some special structures inside that little bulge. Sometimes it's called a terminal button, sometimes it's called a bouton terminale, sometimes it's called a terminal bouton. It's got a number of different names, but there's a little swelling, and there's special structures inside of that swelling. All right, so that's a neuron. And I also see one kind of support cell, namely the Schwann cell, and you know the reason for this Schwann cell. Okay, what's better, fast or slow? Fast. Yeah, it's like one of those commercials, right? Okay, what's better, fast or slow? Faster is better. All right, so the chemical is called myelin, so if the axon is myelinated, that means that it is fast. Myelinated axons transmit electrical impulses very, very quickly. All right. Okay, so here we see that neuron once again. Here is an axon that is coming down and touching that neuron that we were looking at. All right, so here is a junction between a proximal neuron and the one we were looking at. And information only goes in one direction down the axon, and then it's going to excite the neuron down over here. This junction between neurons, let's zoom into this region, looks like this, right? So here is that swelling at the tip of an axon. This junction or communication between these two cells is called a synapse. So what is the structural and functional unit of life called? Anybody remember structural and functional unit of life? Cell, yeah, that's good. What's the structural and functional unit of contraction? Sarcomere. Yeah, you guys are good, you're thinking of that stuff. Okay, here's another structural and functional unit that I want you to know. A structural and functional unit of communication between cells is what we call a synapse. So if you know the pieces of one synapse, you pretty much know how all cells communicate with each other. All right, so let's take a look at what's happening here. So a nerve impulse comes down the axon to this terminal button. When it reaches the axon terminus, it's going to excite these vesicles that contain a special signaling compound to move over to the cell membrane, and it fuses with the cell membrane, and then all of this material that's inside the vesicle is released into the space between these two neurons. The space between the two neurons is called the synaptic cleft. This molecule then moves by diffusion from an area of high concentration to low concentration to the neighboring cell membrane. Right? Well, we want to know what the names of these two membranes are. So here is the neuron that comes before the synapse. Here is one that comes after the synapse. So this neuron that's above it is called the presynaptic cell. The one down over here is called the postsynaptic cell. Or this is the presynaptic membrane. Here is the postsynaptic membrane. Right, so that's some important kinds of terminology. All right. When this compound is released, it bumps into the postsynaptic membrane, and there it binds to a protein in the cell membrane, right? And that starts another electrical signal on that dendrite, or it could be a cell body, but here I see it on a dendrite. And what did we say about a dendrite? Is that the sending end or the receiving end of a neuron, a dendrite? That's the receiving end, and it's getting information from this presynaptic neuron in the form of a chemical signal. All right, so this is a really good example of a chemical synapse. Information is transmitted in the presynaptic neuron as an electrical signal. It gets converted into a chemical signal across the synapse, right? And then in the postsynaptic cell, it gets converted back to an electrical signal. So what do we have? We have electrical, chemical, electrical through this particular kind of synapse. And this chemical, since it's secreted by a neuron and it's transmitting information, sometimes we call that a neurotransmitter. So all of these particles inside these vesicles are called neurotransmitters, and there are a number of different kinds. In physiology, we're really interested in all the different kinds of neurotransmitters. But probably in this class, you should know at least the name of one. A good one to remember is acetylcholine, or you could just abbreviate it ACH. ACH or acetylcholine is a very important neurotransmitter, and as a matter of fact, it's the only one that's used between a neuron and a skeletal muscle cell. So that's a really important one. And this process requires a lot of energy. But that's okay, because in the terminal button, what do you see that will provide energy for this process? I see mitochondria all over the place, right? And so that's another reason why there's a swelling at the end of this axon. All right, so information flows from the presynaptic neuron into the postsynaptic neuron, and not the reverse direction. And on the slide, you can actually see why, right? But we might have to talk about it a little bit before you actually see it. Right. Why does information only go from the presynaptic to the postsynaptic neuron when you view this illustration right here? Why is this terminal button the sending part of the synapse, and why is the postsynaptic cell the receiving part? And the reason is, first reason, because only the presynaptic cell has neurotransmitter. The postsynaptic cell can't release any neurotransmitter to send the signal any place because it doesn't have any neurotransmitter. Only the terminal button. That's one reason. Right? And the other reason is because the axon is the sending part, right? And the dendrite is the receiving part. The dendrite receives signals because, right, just like in a response loop, a stimulus will be detected if what is stimulated? A receptor, right? So only the postsynaptic membrane has a receptor for this particular compound. The presynaptic membrane doesn't. So when acetylcholine is released, only the postsynaptic cell can tell that it's in the synaptic cleft, because only the postsynaptic cell has a receptor for it. Right, so information can only go from the presynaptic to the postsynaptic cell through this particular kind of chemical synapse. All right, so we have a stimulus, goes into a dendrite, down the cell body, down an axon. And notice these are all one-way arrows. That's how information flows. And then, if there's a synapse, that cell can share that information with neighboring cells. Let's look at a couple different kinds of neurons. And I'm going to have to go find some examples of different kinds of neurons. Your book kind of grouped them together in a different location, and they turned out to be really small. All right, but here are the three kinds of neurons that I would like for you to know something about. This is the one that we've been looking at so far. A lot of short, highly branched dendrites connected to the cell body, and then one axon that's very long, right? But there's only one of them, and it goes to some really far away, distant location in your body. This is what we call a multipolar neuron, because here's the cell body, there are projections on one side of it, here's another projection on the other side of it, right? So we call this multipolar. The two ends of this cell look a lot different, right? Multipolar. This multipolar neuron is used as a motor neuron, sending information from the central nervous system out to the periphery. And multipolar neurons are also used as interneurons, both association interneurons or somatic motor neurons or autonomic motor neurons. And let me show you with that other slide that we were looking at. Where was that at? All right, so this one right here, this motor neuron, that's a multipolar neuron that we've been looking at. Or this association neuron is multipolar, but not this sensory neuron. That's not a multipolar neuron. Let's take a look and see what kind of neuron this sensory neuron is. Right, so I'm going to put this away, go back down to almost the end of the chapter. Okay, and here I see a neuron that has two projections that are equal in length, at least on this illustration. This is what we call a bipolar neuron. A bipolar neuron is going to be for sensory applications. What's another name for sensory? Afferent. Yeah, we don't usually pronounce it afferent, but I do in lectures so that you could tell the difference between afferent and efferent. The way you really pronounce it is afferent and efferent, which sometimes is hard to understand. So I say afferent and efferent. So this is an afferent neuron or sensory neuron. We don't have many bipolar neurons, but only in special sense organs like eyes and nose have bipolar neurons, and pretty much no place else in the body. Right, and that takes us to the third kind by shape, right? And this is what we call a unipolar or pseudo-unipolar neuron, because here is the cell body. There is one projection coming out of the cell body. There are no dendrites all over the place, right, on the other side, so it's not a multipolar. So there's one process coming off, so sometimes we call that unipolar, but after it goes a short distance, look what happens. It bifurcates into two long processes. And so a lot of people call that pseudo-unipolar, because there's true one process coming off, but it splits into two. So some people call that pseudo-unipolar. This neuron right here is going to be used for gathering information from the periphery and bringing it into the central nervous system. What did we call that when information is gathered in the peripheral nervous system and brought into the central nervous system? What kind of function was that? Same as this one over here. It is sensory. When information goes from the peripheral nervous system to the central nervous system, that is sensory. So let me go back. Sensory. Where is that on this illustration right here? It is this neuron right here. This is a sensory neuron, and we see that the shape of this one is going to be unipolar, or sometimes we call it pseudo-unipolar. And what's another name for sensory? Maybe you have that in your notes. Afferent, right? So if we look at that neuron once again, come back down over to here, this is an afferent or sensory neuron. Okay. This long process, after it comes out of the single process out of the cell body, it's got two different names. We have a peripheral process and a central process. So what the heck does that mean? The peripheral process has receptor endings, and the central process has terminal buttons on it that can release neurotransmitter. So information on this bipolar neuron can go only from the peripheral process right into the central process. right? It goes in that one direction. So if you want to draw an arrow in right there, that would be fine with me. So let's go back to that original illustration once again. And what do we mean by central process and peripheral process? All right, so here is that pseudo-unipolar neuron, and this is that receiving process. So these are acting like dendrites. And what part of your body is this in? Is this in the periphery or central nervous system? Periphery. So this is the peripheral process of that pseudo-unipolar neuron, and the cell body would be right here. Here is that second process, and what part of the body is this process in? Central nervous system, so we call this the central process, right? So that's how we got those two names for the opposite ends of that neuron. One is in the central nervous system, others in the peripheral nervous system, and you know what? Probably this color coding right here sort of shows you that. It doesn't show you that. Right. But here is that unipolar neuron. Peripheral process is in the peripheral nervous system. The central process is in the central nervous system. I don't know what these colors mean. Secretory region, conducting region, receptive region. That sort of makes sense. Okay, so that is the neurons that transmit electrical information. So I do want you to know them by shape, what their names are, namely multipolar, bipolar, unipolar. And then because they have different shapes, they have different what? Different functions. And so I want you to be able to tell me what the function is if you see the shape or if I tell you what the shape of a neuron is. So a unipolar is always going to be sensory. A multipolar is always going to be motor and also maybe association neuron within the central nervous system, never leaving. And a bipolar is going to be sensory or afferent as well. Okay, so those are neurons. The second kind of cell that we have that make up the nervous system are what we call support cells or neuroglia cells. Here is an exam figure. Okay, I think I have, this is an exam figure. So here is a neuron. We've been talking about these. Okay, and this other little cell right here with all these other processes, this is what we call a support cell or a neuroglia cell. Sometimes we call it a neuroglial cell, either one like that. This one is what we find in the central nervous system only. We don't see it in the peripheral nervous system. And this is an astrocyte, because when people found this while looking through the microscope, it looked like this was a star with sunlight coming out of it in all different directions, right? Light rays coming out. So they call this an astrocyte. All right, so I see a neuron, and I also see a blood vessel right here. This is a capillary. So blood is flowing through this capillary. One of the jobs of an astrocyte is to take nutrients that are in a blood vessel, namely this capillary, and deliver it directly to a neuron. So it's a door-to-door delivery system. So nutrients, for instance, like glucose, will be transmitted. So glucose doesn't have to wander around inside the brain to find this neuron. It is delivered to it directly via this astrocyte. All right. The other thing I notice is that this astrocyte forms pretty much a complete coat around the capillary. And that's an important barrier. We call that the blood-brain barrier. Astrocytes make a blood-brain barrier so that not every compound that's in the circulatory system can get into the central nervous system, because there are many toxic compounds that are in our blood. And we need to have a functioning brain, right, day in and day out, every second of our lives. So astrocytes help protect the brain from toxins that are in the blood because astrocytes make a blood-brain barrier. That's really important. You're going to be really familiar with that. Pharmaceutical companies know a lot about the blood-brain barrier because a lot of drugs that they design to fight disease in the brain, right, if they're given intravenously or if they're absorbed into the blood, they can't even get into the brain because of the blood-brain barrier, right? And so then the chemists have to go back and redesign the drug so that it can get across the barrier to get into the brain to fight maybe, for instance, cancer, if it's a chemotherapeutic agent, for instance. All right, so that's the job of an astrocyte. The astrocyte is also important because it can direct where this neuron is going to grow, right? It will tell where dendrites are going to be placed, where axons are going to be placed, because that's really important. Differentiation of a stem cell into a neuron happens only before birth. We call that a fetal process. So the number of neurons that you have, or the neurons that you have right now, this is a better way of saying it, the neurons that you have right now were the ones that you had before you were born, because they were developed right prenatally. And you don't have the same number because as we grow older, these neurons die, but they're not replaced like skin cells. You're familiar with skin cells. The stratum basale is undergoing mitosis all the time, but neurons don't do that. Right? But there is something special that happens. Right? This one cell, even though it can't divide and make two daughter cells, it can still change its shape and make more connections with neighboring neurons when it gets a signal from an astrocyte. So the shape of this neuron can change, right? It can reach out and communicate with more neurons in different kinds of ways if it gets a signal from an astrocyte. And sometimes we call these things brain-derived neurotrophic factor. Neurotrophic factor just are factors that allows your brain to grow, not in the number of cells, but in the shape of cells that you already have. And they might get bigger or smaller. Okay, the number will pretty much stay the same as a result of activity of this astrocyte. Right, that also is kind of scary because one of the things that we know about a learning process, when we learn something, right, we know that the shape of these neurons change, and the size of a neuron changes, right? It gets direction from this astrocyte right here. And so I'm always amazed that students are willing to turn their brain over to me every semester to get rebuilt. All these neurons are rebuilding themselves, right? Whenever you learn new material. Just like if you were to exercise a muscle constantly, what would happen to that muscle? Bigger and stronger. What would happen to that bone that muscle is connected to? Bigger and stronger, right? When you take a rigorous class and stretch your brain, guess what happens to your brain? It gets bigger and stronger as well by forming new connections between different neurons. So the shape of your brain, there's nothing after the class is over, is nothing like the shape of it before you took the class. And it's pretty much like that for every class, right, that you take. So you kind of have to be careful of what you allow your brain to experience, right? Stick around people that will allow your brain to develop properly, not improperly, right? Because it definitely will change. All right, so this is one kind of neuroglia cell that's in the central nervous system. All right, here is another kind of cell. It's a neuroglia cell. I see some neurons. What's the job of these neurons once again? Neurons transmit electrical information, right, fast over long distances. Neuroglia cells, on the other hand, are support cells, like that astrocyte. Here's another support cell. This one is an immune cell, and it is looking for bacteria and fungi and other kinds of things that are in your brain that don't belong there, including tumor cells. And when it bumps into a tumor cell or some foreign substance, it can then destroy that particular cell. Right? So this is a disease-fighting cell, and it is called a microglia cell or microglial cell. We saw something like this in the skin. It was called a Langerhans cell or a dendritic cell. It was for immune response. It kind of has the same kind of shape. So these, when we looked at these support cells, it almost looks like it has dendrites all over the place. And that's why that Langerhans cell was called a dendritic cell, because of all these long, highly branched processes. But the microglia cell doesn't transmit electrical information. It's an immune cell, right? So it's a self-defense cell. And it is found in the central nervous system. So we've seen two so far in the central nervous system, astrocytes and microglia cells. We got two more to look at. Okay, so I see the brain. brain or spinal cord tissue down over here, I see a row of cells, kind of looks like an epithelium, looks like what, a simple cuboidal epithelium. And right above it is a fluid-filled cavity. We have fluid-filled cavities in our brain, and they're called ventricles. That fluid comes from these ependymal cells. So ependymal cell is another kind of support cell that secretes the fluid into these chambers that are deep inside the brain, and even it surrounds the brain. So when we get into central nervous system, we'll learn something about those cavities and the fluid and how it flows in the brain. That fluid comes from ependymal cells. And they also form a barrier between the fluid that's in ventricles and the brain. Right? Because what's ever in this fluid right here, sometimes it might be toxic and it might interfere with the neuronal activity inside the brain. So this also acts as a barrier. So it's a third kind of cell that we find in the central nervous system. Oh, I didn't tell you what the name of this fluid is, but it tells you here on the slide. So it's good that I mention it right now. It's called cerebrospinal fluid. So when you look at this term, cerebrospinal fluid, what can you tell me about that term, cerebrospinal? It's not cerebral, B-A-L, it's cerebrospinal. Spinal. What does that mean, cerebrospinal? What are we putting together? The brain and the spinal cord. So this fluid we find where? In the brain and spinal cord together. So we call it cerebrospinal fluid. All right, the last kind of cell in the central nervous system. Here I see three axons, and I see this cell wrapping itself around three different axons. And this is what we call an oligodendrocyte. It has a number of processes, and they all reach out to an axon and roll around the axon. And these processes right here secrete a compound we call myelin, and that acts as insulation. And this oligodendrocyte is doing the job of a Schwann cell, right? But a Schwann cell is found only in the peripheral nervous system. The oligodendrocyte is in the central nervous system. So it acts like insulation, and it allows for nerve impulse to skip down the axon, which means it's going to be transmitted how? Fast or slow? Fast, right? All right, so a myelin sheath allows for a fast transmission of a nerve impulse down an axon. When somebody has multiple sclerosis, it is this myelin sheath that degenerates and forms a scar tissue, in which case those neurons then can't transmit information with the right speed, and that can produce sensory deficits or motor deficits. And fortunately, it's not really lethal much anymore these days. It can be controlled or partially controlled. Right, but it's really unfortunate if somebody does come down with multiple sclerosis. And we think that is an autoimmune disease where a person's own immune system attacks these cells or the myelin that are in these projections surrounding these axons. All right, so an oligodendrocyte is also in the central nervous system. And what's the job of an oligodendrocyte? Speeds up the nerve speed or the conduction of a nerve impulse down an axon. Okay, that's its job to do that. And the microglia cell, what's the job of the microglia cell? Fight infection, right? And the job of an astrocyte, what does that do? Yeah, you could consider it's a door-to-door delivery system or makes blood-brain barrier. Those would be a couple of good bullet points, right? And then there was one more in the central nervous system. Does anybody know what the fourth one was called? The ependymal cell. The ependymal cell lines cavities inside the brain and also produces cerebrospinal fluid that fills those cavities. All right, so those are four kinds of support cells. I do want you to be able to know their name by their shape. If I show you the shape of one of these cells, you should know their name. But you should also have, just like organelles, you should have an idea of what some of their functions are, at least one function, right? Myelin sheath for oligodendrocyte. Okay, in the central nervous system, when somebody gets a spinal cord injury, does their spinal cord grow back? Or is somebody paralyzed forever? Does anybody know spinal cord injuries? Do they grow back, for instance? No, right? So you can if you have a spinal cord injury, you can become a paraplegic or quadriplegic, depending on the level of that spinal cord injury. And these axons in the spinal cord don't grow back because it's the job of this oligodendrocyte to prevent regrowth. So that might seem a little strange, but it's the job of this oligodendrocyte to restrict the growth of neurons in the central nervous system. It secretes factors that inhibit the regrowth of axons, and that's why nobody can recover from spinal cord injuries. All right. The other kind of cell that makes a myelin sheath, let me see where it is. Ah, it was the next slide. Okay, are Schwann cells. Notice it doesn't have multiple processes. One Schwann cell completely encircles one part of an axon and only one axon. These are found in the peripheral nervous system. So oligodendrocytes in central nervous system, Schwann cells in peripheral. Their job is the same in the sense that they speed up the rate of a nerve impulse or transmission of a nerve impulse, speeds up maybe by a factor of 100 or so. But now the Schwann cells, when this axon is damaged in the peripheral nervous system, actually promotes regeneration of this axon. Right, so if somebody cuts a nerve in their arm and they lose control of fingers or sensation in their fingers, they can regain that control or sensation because the Schwann cells will guide the growth of this axon back to those tissues. So it's kind of interesting. Oligodendrocyte will prevent regeneration, but a very similar kind of cell in the peripheral nervous system, namely a Schwann cell, will promote regeneration. That's just the way it is. So these are Schwann cells. The second kind of neuroglia cell that we see in the peripheral nervous system surrounds the cell nucleus of this particular neuron, and it just helps the nerve cell do its particular job. It just supports the job of this neuron. Now, what kind of neuron does this look like to you? Can you recognize this? I know this is the first day that we've ever looked at these neurons before. Okay, but you should eventually should be able to recognize this by shape. Okay, and remember there were three. Let's go over the three kinds. First one we looked at was multipolar. Cell body, one end, a whole bunch of dendrites, one long axon. And that's not what I see right here. Right? Okay, the second one was a bipolar, where there was a cell body, and coming from the cell body there are two separate projections going in opposite directions. And again, this does not look like a bipolar neuron. Here is one process that goes a short distance that bifurcates or splits into two, and that is an exact example of a unipolar or pseudo-unipolar neuron. What's the function of a pseudo-unipolar neuron? Sensory. This is going to be 100% sensory. It's never going to be used for a motor pathway. Okay. Oh, I just remembered, in lab we have a bunch of your post-its, your stickers, in a little case upstairs. I don't want to say your name because I'm recording. But were you looking for those little post-its? I think you left them up there. Okay. Okay. I was talking to, the initials are BR. Raise your hand. You're not quite sure I'm talking to you. Yeah, but your post-its are up there, so you can stop by lab sometime. Okay. The other thing I want to mention before I move on to the next topic, somebody left some answer keys, end of chapter questions in lab from this morning. The center table left them on one of the bone boxes. So if you need these answer keys for studying over the weekend, pick them up right here. Did anybody leave these that you know of? I think it was from our lab, not from one from last night. Okay. If not, I'll take them back up to lab. All right, so those are support cells. Some we find in peripheral nervous system, some we find in central nervous system, and you know what some of their functions are. Okay. All right, we've looked at the synapse already. And what's one way to think of a synapse? It's a structural and functional unit of what? Communication between cells, right? So what do you have to know about that synapse? Let's go over it again. All right, so here is a nice picture of a synapse. Here is the presynaptic cell. Presynaptic cell has neurotransmitter within vesicles. Right? The postsynaptic cell has receptors for that neurotransmitter. When a nerve impulse comes down, This neurotransmitter in synaptic vesicles is released into the synaptic cleft, moves over to the postsynaptic membrane, and initiates another electrical signal in the postsynaptic cell. So information goes electrical, chemical, electrical. And in the next couple of years, you'll be learning a lot about synapses, different kinds of synapses, but they all will be based on this one that you're looking at right now. Right? The terminal button will contain neurotransmitter. The postsynaptic membrane will contain receptors that can sense these neurotransmitters. And what was the name of one neurotransmitter that we were looking at that I mentioned? Oh, there it is right there. Acetylcholine. Acetylcholine, an important neurotransmitter. Okay. Let's look at some questions. Can information ever be passed from the postsynaptic neuron back to the presynaptic neuron through the synapse? And that's just a yes or no question, but you got to know why. Okay. Can information go from, what does it say? From the postsynaptic, which is this one here, back up to the presynaptic neuron. Can information go that direction? And you say no. Good. So maybe you could even just draw in an arrow. Information goes in this direction, right? And I guess it's really important to know why, and that's only because the presynaptic cell has neurotransmitter, or only the presynaptic cell has neurotransmitter. And only the postsynaptic cell has receptor. Right? So the presynaptic cell won't know that the neurotransmitter is in the synaptic cleft because it doesn't have a receptor. Okay. All right, what else do we get to talk about? I'm going to pass over some of this. Here, let's look at some terminology. Maybe I'll talk about some of these electrical properties, maybe not. But let's look at some terminology. Okay, we have gray matter and we have white matter. What the heck is this stuff? Okay, well, if we look at this slide, this astrocyte, okay, and if we look at an oligodendrocyte that we see right here, is making a compound called myelin, and it kind of looks white. So if we're looking at white matter, it means that axons are myelinated. And there are certain parts of our brain and spinal cord that look white. That means that there are axons in that region that are myelinated by oligodendrocytes. And remember, what is the part of the neuron that's the axon? What's the job of an axon? Sending. It's the sending part, right? So white matter is sending information because it's myelinated axons. Gray matter, is that what it says? Axons with myelin sheaths around them. That is white matter because myelin looks white. Gray matter, on the other hand, right, are parts of a neuron that are not myelinated. And the part that is not myelinated is the nerve cell body and dendrites. So gray matter is just groups of nerve cell bodies and dendrites, but not axons going someplace. In the cortex of the central nervous system, what part of the organ is a cortex? Is it superficial or deep part? Cortex is, like think of bone. Where's cortical bone? On the outside, it's the superficial part. Medullary bone is the spongy bone deep inside. So the central nervous system cortex is the part of the brain that is superficial. It's on the outside, and it is made up of groups of nerve cell bodies and dendrites that are not myelinated, so the cortex is gray matter. When we look at brain, we're going to see gray matter and white matter. Gray matter is going to be on the surface of the brain. Right? If there is a group of nerve cell bodies someplace in the central nervous system, we call it a nucleus. And what color is a nucleus going to look like inside the brain? Okay, a nucleus is nerve cell bodies. Nerve cell bodies are not myelinated. All right, so a cluster of nerve cell bodies is gray matter, so nuclei are going to look gray. A lot of the brain is going to look white, but those areas that contain nerve cell bodies will look gray, so they're easy to detect from the background that's white. All right, group of nerve cell bodies. There's another object that we call a ganglion. Again, we see nerve cell bodies, And again, it's not going to be myelinated, so these are going to look a little gray, but these are not in the central nervous system, these are in the peripheral nervous system. So a ganglion and a nucleus are pretty much the same thing, but one is located in the central nervous system and the other is located in the peripheral nervous system. And you'll become familiar with these because we're going to use these when we talk about different parts of the brain or peripheral nervous system. And I'll refer back to this definition of these terms. All right, so let's practice. What is white matter? I see it right here. Axons that are myelinated. The sending part of a neuron, it's sending signals someplace. All right. And if there's a group of these axons that are myelinated, taking signals someplace within the central nervous system, we call that a tract. Okay, so I see a bunch of myelinated axons in the central nervous system taking information someplace, we call that a tract. And what color is a tract going to be? It is going to be white because it's myelinated. Right? So white matter are myelinated axons. What about, that's a tract, what about a nucleus? What can you tell me about a nucleus? It's gray, right? And it's not sending information long distances. It's not a tract. It's just a nucleus where information is being compared and shared. Okay? It's not transmitting information. All right, so nerve tract, myelinated axons in the central nervous system, as opposed to a nerve is in the peripheral nervous system. It's kind of similar to a tract because it contains white matter, it contains myelinated axons, but it's in the peripheral nervous system. All right, so tract in the CNS, nerve in the peripheral nervous system. Okay, one of the first slides that you have on this particular chapter is right here. And there's, here it is. Okay, so what do I see? Central nervous system, peripheral and peripheral nervous system. And where do we have nerves? Where do we have nerves? Central nervous system or peripheral nervous system? Nerves are in the peripheral nervous system. They're myelinated axons, all right? But what do we have in the central nervous system? It's not labeled on this slide. What's the corresponding thing in the central nervous system to a nerve? It's called a tract, right? It's called a tract, myelinated axons in the central nervous system, okay? In the peripheral nervous system, we can have a group of nerve cell bodies, and it forms this little bulge in a nerve. We call that a ganglion. Right, that's going to be gray matter. So non-myelinated cell bodies and dendrites in the peripheral nervous system is called a ganglion. We have similar kinds of things in the central nervous system. Can anybody remember what a group of nerve cell bodies in the central nervous system is called? It is called a nucleus. That's right, the same thing. So just by different locations, we change the name of something. Right? Nucleus in the CNS, ganglia in the PNS. And you'll become familiar with that the more we talk about it. All right, so let's look at a nerve. When did we go to, what, 1205 in here? Yeah, we're good. Okay. All right, so let's look at a nerve. A nerve is going to remind you of a muscle. Okay, so, and where do we find nerves once again? Central nervous system or peripheral nervous system? Yeah, peripheral nervous system, right? Because there are tracts in the central nervous system. So here is a nerve, and I see an axon. It's myelinated, right? Here's the myelin sheath. Do you remember the name of these cells that myelinate an axon in the peripheral nervous system? That's a Schwann cell, right? And so this axon transmits information very rapidly, right? Around the myelin sheath, there's a connective tissue layer, which we call the endoneurium. Doesn't conduct electrical information, but it just protects this one axon. And if we have a group of axons all grouped together, we call that a fascicle. And surrounding a fascicle is the perineurium. And if we put a bunch of fascicles together, we get the nerve. Surrounding the whole nerve is the epineurium. Right, so we got endoneurium, perineurium, and epineurium. Remember, epi just means on top, endo means deep inside, peri just means surrounding a fascicle. So there are a number of different connective tissue sheaths that surround a nerve cell or fiber, a fascicle, or the whole nerve itself. And nerves are pretty big, so a lot of nerves have their own blood supply. And that's what I see right here, blood vessels. This red would be an artery, this blue one right here would be a vein. Tracts in the brain don't have all these connective tissue sheaths and blood vessels associated with them, but in the peripheral nervous system they do, because the peripheral nervous system is traumatized more readily than your brain is, right? Because you just use it a lot more. It's not protected by the cranium, for instance. All right, so this is a nerve, right? You get the epi blood vessels, all of this stuff. Okay. All right, so here is what we started to talk about, a response loop or reflex arc. And a reflex arc always starts with a stimulus and ends in a response. And what produces a response? What always produces a response? It's on this slide right here. What produces a response? I just highlighted it. An effector, that's right. An effector produces a response. And remember, there's some different classes of effectors for the autonomic nervous system. What are three effectors that we should be aware of? Autonomic nervous system, things that we don't have to consciously think about but are still controlled. Heart muscle, cardiac muscle, smooth muscle, and glands. What's the effector organ for the somatic nervous system? Skeletal muscle, right? That's under voluntary control. Okay, somatic nervous system. Okay, well, next time we're going to finish up by talking about some signal processing patterns in the nervous system, and then that's pretty much going to be about it for this chapter. Okay, so sinus sheet is going around. No, it's up here. So I hope you all know where to get those study guides, and you can start working on them over the weekend.